far have we got? Did we get you, Mr. Sherman? Did we get, we got Mr. Marshall. Mr. Hender, are you prepared to do your picture and poem?
No, sir, I got it.
Who are you?
Ahaziah.
That's typical. Ahaziah, we expect Ahaziah not to show up for the picture and the poem. What about you, Mr. G?
Yes, sir, I did get it, but it's on my desk. It's on my desk.
Don't have it memorized.
No, sir.
How about you, Paula? Are you ready for us? Stand up and give it to us. Show us that arrow. Everybody, I want you to fix your eyes upon Paula. Who put that arrow through her back? Look at him. Look at that sinister look upon his face. That smirk.
I want that
look.
All right, tell us who you were. Hey, who killed me? Oh, sure. Okay. All right, let's hear it for Jay. If you wear those arrows to other classes, that's what I want. Well, that's where the real extra credit goes. Stirs up interest in our class, you know. Okay, Jay, do you have anything for us? Anything for us, Jay? You'll be ready for Sunday. There he goes on his chariot. That's pretty good artwork. There comes the arrow, ready to... You got your arrow on front backwards.
Backwards?
Oh, that's right. He shot you through the back. That looked like the back end of the arrow. All right. What about over here in Judah? Who hasn't had a chance to present their man yet? All right, come on. Here we come with King Jehoram, who had an interesting problem. Show us the picture. Okay.
Jordan had his brothers go to Judah and Simon go. In his time of war, he was in bad, but was God.
Okay, all right. And we're ready to hear from Kelly. Here it comes. Who put that arrow through her back? Look at him back there. Smirk on his face. You bumped off two of our cakes, Jehu. Go ahead. He didn't last too long. There's not a whole lot to say about him, except he got bumped off while he was visiting his cousin. Okay, learn to say his name, Ahaziah. Ahaziah. Okay, let's sound off over here in Judah. Get all those kings out here.
Rehoboam.
Abijam.
Jehoshaphat.
Ahaziah. Ahaziah.
Ahaziah.
Athaliah. Okay, let's hear Israel sound off. Where's our first man?
Jeroboam.
You're Jeroboam.
And I'm
Nadab.
Nadab.
Where's Omri?
Omri's
absent. How come Omri's always absent? Omri, Ahaz, Ahaziah, Joram, and the ever popular two drivers, furious play. Okay. Now, we're right in the middle. We're right in the middle of the revolution of 841. Aren't you excited? We're naming all the people that Jehu bumped off.
Yeah.
First, there was Jehoram, if you prefer. Then Ahaziah, we've mentioned. Then Jezebel. Then, we just are down to this point. Jehu pulled an interesting trick. He sent word down to some of the elders of the land. He said, whose side are you on? And they wrote back and said, we're on your side. Of course, he writes back and says, then prove it. Behead the 70 sons of Ahab and pile their heads at the gate of my city. Who said this? Look at him back there with a smirk upon his face. Slunk down in his chair. That Jehu was crafty, I'm telling you. And so the next morning, when they approached the gates of the city, there were two piles of skulls, 35 in each, to be exact, if anybody was counting. The flies hovered all over the place. Jehu just let the crowds gather all day and then finally went out and addressed them. And oh, the hypocrisy of it all. He said, you thought I did bad when I killed my master, but look what your elders have done. Rather clever way, making the people think that all the elders are backing him in his bid for power. Pretty smart, pretty shrewd of you back there, Jehu. And then 42 princes from Judah. Now remember, the two royal families have now been intermarried here for a period of time. So a lot of the princes of Judah would be relatives of the leaders in the north. And 42 of these princes were making their way to Jezreel. I don't know if their visit was totally innocent or not, whether they were just caught in the crossfire, so to speak, or whether maybe they were hearing rumors of revolt and were trying to go north to help their cousins. I don't know, but the record says they were scratched right here. So we have Jehoram, Ahaziah, Jezebel, 70 sons of Ahab, 42 princes of Judah that were killed. But the most despicable thing that Jehu ever did was when he wiped out the Baal worship. Not so much the way, not so much the fact that he did it, but the way in which he did it. First of all, he secured the support of a religious zealot by the name of Jehonadab. This Jehonadab, we learn from later scripture, had established a sect that did not believe in drinking wine of any way, shape, or form, even raising vineyards or living in cities. They were intensely loyal to their father, Jonadab, as it turns out. And they were kind of like, what would we liken them to in our society? Like the Amish. They're sort of misfits in society. And everything okay, Maiden? Okay. Hope everything works out for you. Okay, so these followers of Jonadab were sort of like the modern Amish. Now, Jehu, he bumped off a lot of people. Now, he wants to make it appear that the religious, the conservative religious fundamentalist groups are backing him. And so he invites Jonadab to come up and stand in his chariot. Now, Jehu was a politician par excellence. He knew that would send a signal to everybody in the country. I've often wondered why Jehonadab allowed himself to be used in this way. I don't think he could be that dumb to see what was going on. And I have to say this, though it's, again, you're trying to read back into history and understand some of these things. I have to think that Jonadab was an example of some religious people that I know of that think the end justifies the means. But Jehonadab perhaps felt like anything to get rid of these Baals. By hook or by crook, by deceit or whatever it takes, get rid of Baal worship. There are a lot of people that believe that very way today. Tell me how you did it, Jehu, your trickery with the Baal worship. You pretended that you were a Baal worshiper, and as yet no one knew where you stood religiously. You said, I'm going to throw a wing ding for Baal. All you Baal worshipers, come down, come out of the woodwork, and come down to the temple. You got them all in the temple. You went in, pretended to go through the sacrifices, and then you whispered to your servants to get all the Yahweh worshipers out of here. There were some of them that were, you know, how people do in politics. They'll do anything to gain the favor of the king. So they got them out of the building. Then he had his guards seal off the doors and charged through the building and slew all of the worshipers. Tore down the Baal temple, made an outside John out of it. Did you pick up on that?
That's what it said. What he did.
Now, it wasn't wrong to exterminate the Baal worshippers because they had the sanction of the law of Moses. What was wrong in what he did? He used deceit. And I don't believe that the end justifies the means. And you know, I wrote that chapter in that book. When you read that chapter, how many of you read the chapter on Jehu and the little book? That's the chapter they almost wouldn't claim. In fact, they insisted on editorial changes because he didn't like what I said about Jehu. See, they had a problem because it says toward the end here, it says in 2 Kings 10:30 well, read 2 Kings 10:30 and I'll show you what the problem was. What does it say? Who has it? Put your arrow back on there.
And the Lord said to Jehu, because you have done well in executing what is right in my eyes, and have done to the house of Ahab according to all that was in my heart, your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel.
Now, the editor of the Standard took that to be a blanket endorsement of everything that Jehu did. But notice the limitation in the verse. It doesn't say anything about the Baal worshippers, does it? It says about the wiping out of the house of Ahab. They had it coming. But the Baal worshippers, okay that he wiped them out, but not the deceit, not the trickery. And I think you have to be very much, it's easy. When you're the victim to see, or when you're looking at it as a neutral observer, to see how some people operate by the philosophy the end justifies the means. But a lot of you, if you were in positions of power to do so, would take the same philosophy. You'd have the same idea in your mind. And you'd think, well, as long as my goal out here is okay, doesn't matter how I get there. Bryce? Well, it goes back to the time when Elijah predicted way back there in Ahab's reign that Ahab would be wiped out, and then that was postponed because there was a temporary repentance. And you remember it says it will not happen in your days, it will happen in the days of your son. So yes, there was a prophecy. Well, this is not warfare. First of all, we're talking about here. It's not warfare. You're wanting to get me off the subject into the whole discussion of ethics. But I say, as a general principle, means is not the end does not justify the means. But sometimes you get into situations where you have a lesser of evils, of course. But that doesn't justify Jehu. There were other ways of doing it. He didn't have to use deceit. It wasn't the only means available. It wasn't an alternative between using deceit and, you know, something worse. He could have issued an edict. The Baal worshippers would have been known throughout the community. He could have ordered them to leave the country. He could have ordered them all to assemble and say, you know, this is outlawed now. Anybody who practices Baal worship is going to die. There are ways of doing it without using deceit. So the illustration you give is not applicable in this case. He's not involved in a war with these people. He pretends to be one of them. I don't know whether, you know, you're asking whether a Christian can be a spy and lie and all that sort of thing for his government. That's something you have to decide for yourself. I couldn't do it. Maybe you could. I don't think the end justifies the means. I don't think Scripture teaches that at all. That we have to have good ends. First of all, our goals have to be proper and in harmony with the will of God. But not only that, that's great. Some people's goals aren't even right. But that's just the first step. And once you've established goals that are appropriate for a Christian, then you need to examine how you're going to get to those goals and make sure those are appropriate ways. And in the book, I give all kinds of examples of the way this principle shows itself in the work of the church, how some churches sacrifice biblical doctrine because they say the Lord wants us to grow as churches. So if an eldership gets in the way of a church growth, throw out the eldership. Or God wants us to have a lot of converts. If baptism gets in the way of having a lot of converts, play it down. And there are a lot of people that have that idea. Believe you me, and the longer you go in the church, you'll find people like this. They establish what they perceive to be a worthwhile goal. Or let's say here at the Bible College, we want to establish the Bible College. We want to grow. See, it's a vicious circle. A lot of things we'd like to do, we cannot do until we grow. But until you do certain things, you aren't going to grow. So it's a vicious circle. You see the problem? So we might adopt all kinds of unworthy means, you know. We could put out the lie sheets about other Bible colleges. Maybe even truth sheets. Or we could go up and invade the campuses of other Bible colleges and persuade them. Or we could put out brochures that absolutely lied about the whole situation down here. And there are all kinds of things you can do if you want to use unworthy means. And, well, the Lord wants us to grow, so whatever we do to grow, I can't buy that. Apparently Standard Publishing Company could buy it. They didn't want to print what I had to say. Wouldn't print until finally we get to knock heads through correspondence for about 3 months, and finally we agreed upon a compromise. What you're reading in the book is a watered-down version of what was originally written. Because they wouldn't print what was originally written. Not because it wasn't written well, but because they didn't believe it. I had it. Anyway, this is Jehu. Now, let me point out a couple of failures of Jehu's. He did get rid of Baal worship temporarily, but 2 Kings 10, 29 and 31 says he retained the golden calves, and he did not walk according to the law of God with all of his heart. So he's wiped out the old generation of leadership. He's removed them from office. And really, after Jehu got through, I hate to say this, the country was in worse shape when he took over. And we'll see that very clearly here in just a minute. In spite of the fact that he got rid of Baal. One little sidelight that's not in the Bible but fits in here historically. Jehu is the only king of Israel we have a picture of. And it has to do with an episode that occurred in 841 when the Assyrians were moving westward toward the Mediterranean Sea. And we find out that Jehu was among several other kings that was depicted on this Assyrian monument in these picture panels with text down here that described who was in the pictures. And here was an artist's picture, at least, of Jehu. Now, how faithful that is to how he actually looked, it's interesting to notice the kind of hat that he wore. It looks like an elf's hat. And the kind of beard that he has, and the kind of dress that he was wearing. How close that is to him is not obviously not a photograph, but he's the only king of the Bible that we have an actual representation of him in the ancient monuments. So this is called the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser. And it tells, and I give you there in your syllabus, the inscription that occurs on that monument. Well, Ahaziah of Judah was wiped out in that revolution of 841. And the ever popular Athaliah sets about to murder her own grandchildren. You ruthless, wretch of a woman. Why would she do that? Here's the reason. Not just me. In the southern kingdom of Judah, the queen mother had enormous power. That's not true up in Israel, but apparently in Judah, the queen mother, not the wife of the king, as is normally the case, where the wife of the king would be, have enormous power. In Judah, if you read all through and read very carefully, it appears that the queen mother had a lot of clout. Now, with her son dead, and the potential of a grandson assuming the throne, she would lose her position as queen mother and the power that went with it. So she proceeded to try to wipe out all of her grandchildren. One child survived, an infant, rescued by a young lady named Jehoshaphat. She knew her mother. She knew the kind of woman Athaliah was. And Jehoshaphat took the baby, and she was married to the high priest Jehoiada. We don't know too many priests in Old Testament history, but here's a good one. Name is Jehoiada, and they hid him in the temple. How many years? Well, 6+ years, and he was in his 7th year when they finally brought him out of hiding. They secretly sent for various leaders of the nation, and military and Levites and what else, whatever, and brought them there into the temple area. And on the given day, they anointed this young child as king of Judah. Athaliah heard the trumpets blowing, heard the commotion, comes running over from the palace, which is next door, to find out what's going on. And here, the only surviving son of the house of David. Remember the promise God made to David? As long as there was a throne, there'd be someone from his dynasty to sit upon that throne. Well, that almost failed. Athaliah almost succeeded in thwarting that promise. But here was Joash, 7-year-old kid, anointed king. What did she cry when she ran in the door? I love it. Treason! Treason! Well, what do you think she'd done 7 years before, 6+ years before? She had no right to the throne. She was not of the dynasty of David. Killed her own flesh and blood. Now, it takes a traitor to know one, I guess. It takes one to know one, we used to say to little kids. Somebody calls a name. Takes one to know one. I guess Athaliah proves that to be the case. She was a traitor herself, and she recognized what she called treason right off the bat. Well, they let her get outside the temple, and then they slew her, and so we're going to have a Joash here. Jewy Joash. That has a ring to it, don't you think? The 7-year-old kid who became a king. Okay, so let's talk about Jewy Joash and the minority of this King Joash. Let me have you to write in the margin of your syllabus on page 270. It is thought by many Bible scholars that this is the period of the prophet Joel. Thought by many that this is the period of the prophet Joel. That's a debated subject, but many scholars place him during this period right here. Jehoiada calls a meeting, assembly of the people and the king, and he makes them take a pledge that they would be the Lord's people. Now, it comes out if you read Chronicles, not so much in Kings, but if you read Chronicles, it comes out that during Athaliah's 7-year reign, she had virtually closed down the temple of the Lord. Now, she was the daughter of Jezebel, remember. And Jezebel was a Baal worshiper, remember. And this Athaliah apparently tried to close up the temple. So, the people needed to be brought back to a sense of their obligation and covenant with the Lord. And Jehoiada does that. And it tells us here in 2 Chronicles 24:2, and Joash did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Now that's very important. This priest was a tremendous influence upon the young king. He was the regent. In other words, he really ran the government until the king was of age to become full-fledged ruler. And the nation went in the right direction. We read that the Baal temple was destroyed. The chief priest of Baal down there in Judah was executed. Now you see, Baalism had penetrated even into Judah, as well as Israel under Athaliah. We read that the personnel in the temple was reorganized. But we do read 2 Kings 12:3. We need to note that. Somebody who's in Kings, read that. 2 Kings 12:3. So what was wrong with that? All right. There was only one authorized place of public worship. Temple. And we're going to read there are only a couple of times in the history of the Old Testament where the kings really tried to get rid of these high places. The pagan high places were removed several times, but the Yahweh high places were allowed to remain. And I guess people say, well, we just can't make it down there at the temple. We need a place to worship near our home. People have always looked for convenient ways to dispense their obligation to the Lord. Have you noticed? We always look for convenient ways to do our duty to the Lord, rather than following the commandments and directives of the Lord. And can't you hear what many people would have been saying? Oh, well, what difference does it make where you worship as long as your heart is in it? Him justifies the means. We're worshiping God, so What difference does it make?
Well, it doesn't today. You can worship God anywhere. Jesus said that the day was coming when people would worship God in spirit and in truth, not on one mountain or the other mountain, but all over the world. But in Old Testament times, that was to be done in only one place. You examine your own heart and mind and see how much of this end justifies the means of business is embedded already in your thing. Okay, and what else did they do? They repaired the temple, which had become fallen into disrepair during the 7 years that Athaliah reigned. They reinstituted the temple worship. And then Jehoiada died. And the scripture says, after the death of Jehoiada came the princes of Judah and did obeisance to the king. Then the king hearkened unto them, and they forsook the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers. What does that tell you about the personality of Joash? Had he been trained correctly, you think? You don't think he had been? Who raised him? Jehoiada. As long as Jehoiada lived, the young boy did right. But there are some people, the minute they get out from under a godly authority figure, they can't control their freedom. Sometimes they want to do things just to show that they're independent. In the case of Joash, though, it almost seems like he's one of these kind of guys that swayed whichever way things are going. As long as Jehoiada was there with a firm hand, he was all right. He did a lot of good things. In fact, I think we'd have to list Joash on our list of revivals. We had we had Asa, we had Jehoshaphat, now we have Joash. But the tragedy with Joash is that as soon as Jehoiada died, he was swayed by these other princes to go in a totally different direction. It's a terrible, terrible thing to be so wishy-washy. And obviously that he did not share convictions deep down in his soul. He didn't share the convictions of Jehoiada. He did what Jehoiada said, but he didn't really agree with it. And when Jehoiada's son, a prophet by the name of Zechariah, came there into the temple and began to rebuke the king and call his attention to the fact that he was getting off the track, he ordered that prophet killed. Right there in the temple. Jesus makes a reference for that in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 11, verse 51. Talks about Zechariah being slain in the temple. And most people think he's talking about this Zechariah, son of Jehoiada, who was slain because he preached out against King Joash. Well, one other thing about Joash that I neglected to mention before he turned bad, how did he raise money for the repair? I hate to backtrack, but I forgot to mention, I think it's interesting. Julie Joash, how did you raise money to repair the temple? Can you recall that now that you've turned bad on us? Who remembers how she did that? Yeah. Yeah, and that didn't work. The priests and the Levites were too lazy to go out and collect the money. Then what did he do?
Sin offering?
No, he put a box. He put a box in the temple, free will offerings. And the money poured in. Now that tells me something. When he put the fundraising efforts under the priests and the Levites, it didn't bring in any money. He put a free will offering box in the temple and it overflowed with money. Sometimes the people in the pews are more committed to the Lord and love the Lord more than the guys who are in positions of leadership. It's obvious from the story the priests and the Levites didn't do their job. Oh, half-hearted. What did they care about the temple? There are a lot of guys filling pulpits today that don't love the Lord. They ought to get out there and disgrace the ministry. And there are a lot of times I've been in churches here in Florida and stayed in the homes of some of the members of the church, and I felt like in my own heart, I'm not the good, I know that, but in my own heart, I felt like those people were far and away more spiritual, more committed, more dedicated than the preacher that I was working with in that church. It often happens. I was the one preacher not too long ago, we were out calling, he wanted to stop the newsstand, pick up his Playboy magazine. Bill?
Commit.
I suppose he preached on purity. That's how to justify.
You justify something like, oh, I went and said, when I called his hand on, he's going, well, you got to know what the world, you know, that's the same way the Bible college students that I've worked with for 20 years will say, well, after all, if you're going out and preach against sin, you got to know what's going on, don't you? I guess if you're going to operate on cancer, you got to get cancer yourself first, right? If you're going to be an obstetrician, I suppose you have to have a baby first, which eliminates all males from participating as obstetricians. That doesn't follow, does it? You don't have to have a disease to operate on or to understand it. Most doctors understand diseases far better than the people who have the diseases. You don't have to go out and become a sinner in order to be able to expose sin and to be able to show how it affects people. That just galls me to this day when I see this preacher's name. He's changed churches now, but I see his name occasionally. Christian Standard preaching in one of the large churches. Makes my stomach curl. Or one preacher I was out, he was taking me out to lunch one day, and on the way, he told the dirty joke. And it was the worst name that you could hear in television. Two of us were riding out to eat, but we just sat there and laughed. You know, the worst thing to do is somebody tells, it really slaps them in the face. Just look at them. You don't smile. They're laughing. You didn't get it? I said, yeah, I got it. Crossed him off my list. God called me. He was still one kind of student. And about a year ago, he called me and wanted me to recommend him to the church. You know, when you're out private, not up in the pulpit, not in the limelight. You know what guys are made of. I know people can change. You're saying, well, maybe you're holding that against me. That was a long time ago. Yeah, that's true. People can change. Once you've had something like that happen, you're not too enthusiastic about recommending that kind of person to the congregation. But you don't know whether it's changed. Not only the Lord knows that. I recommend somebody to the church, I want to be able to do it in good time. How'd I get on? Joash! All right, now we move up to the north, and we've got to talk about Hazael. Three things I want to say about Hazael right off the bat. Number one, you recall he was anointed by Elisha. Be sure you know that. This is 2 Kings 8:7. We studied this the other day, but now I want to reinforce that, simply remind you of it. When Elisha was in Damascus, outside the country of Israel, he anointed Hazael, or at least he announced that Hazael was going to be the next king, put it that way. Secondly, he was the greatest of all of the Aramean kings, and you're liable to see that on a matching test. He was the greatest of all the Aramean or Syrian kings. Thirdly, he was angry with Jehu, because Jehu had given tribute to the Assyrians. Run that by you again. Remember I just showed you that picture of Jehu bowing down and giving those gifts to the king of Assyria? The king in Damascus, Hazael, didn't like that. Because up to this point, you see, Israel and Syria had stood together against Assyria. Now here's Israel giving gifts, tribute, surrendering, more or less, to the Assyrian. Hazael didn't like that. And so this leads us now into the period that I want to share with you, what I call the humiliation period of the divided monarchy. The first 40 or so years, what was the relationship between the two kingdoms?
Friendly.
All right. Second 40 or so years, what was the relationship between the two kingdoms?
Buddy-buddy.
Harmony. Hostility. Harmony. And now, humiliation. And the humiliation comes about at the hands of this king Hazael. This big boot, that's Hazael. That's his sandal. His son Ben-Hadad to a lesser degree, but mainly Hazael.
And he was able to dominate both kingdoms during the reign of Athaliah, Joash, and Amaziah. We haven't gotten to that him yet. During the reigns of Jehu, Jehoahaz, and Jehoash. But here's the sandburr during this period. It's Elisha. He's always getting in the way. So fix that in your mind, and that will help you remember now the next 45 or so years of the divided monarchy period. It tells us in the days of Jehu, the Lord cut Israel short, and Hazael smote all in all the borders of Israel from the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites, the Reubenites, the Manassehites, and so on and so forth. And Hazael was actually able to build an empire that looked something like this during his period of pain.